Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Narcissism Dakota, a podcast that's designed to take a comprehensive look at the various facets of narcissism from different psychoanalytic perspectives. I'm your host, Dr. Anthony Mazzella. The title of today's episode is Elate to Erase, Decoding the Blueprint of Narcissistic Relationship Dynamics, Part 1. In this episode, I'll try to demonstrate how and why the dynamics of elation and devaluation are not just power plays to get control of another. Of course, control is part of this dynamic, but it's not the entire story. Well, first, the most important thing is I want to define what I feel is the main characteristic of the narcissist, which is the grandiose sense of self. The grandiose or omnipotent sense of self, in my opinion, is the main structure and what differentiates the narcissist from other personality disorders, such as borderline personality disorder. Since the grandiose and omnipotent sense of self is so important, I think it's going to be of value, and it appears to me necessary to define more clearly the nature of the relationship, the omnipotent relation, how this omnipotence or grandiosity plays out in relationships, and what particular defense mechanisms related to that, to the omnipotent self, are used when these individuals get into relationships. As always, we'll start with the descriptive picture. We'll just define what this looks like. Then, as you all may know, I like to lean on a little bit of theory. So we'll do a little bit of that because having a theory in mind, from my perspective, is always incredibly valuable if you want to think about how to treat these individuals. Well, again, I say treat, I'm coming from the mind of a clinicianer, but I should probably say how to treat or to relate to somebody like this in your life. And then finally, I'll pepper this out, I'll sort of put this through the whole episode, but I'll try to talk more specifically about what specific strategies can one use when trying to relate to somebody, or if you find yourself entangled in this kind of relationship. So let's start with the descriptive picture. Here are three very simple examples that I want to plant in your mind just to lay down some foundation, and we'll build upon them as we go along. In other words, we'll pull them apart and understand these three little examples from different perspectives. Example one, a patient comes in very frustrated with his wife, complaining about how he was doing some renovation around the house. And he got stuck at some point. And he turned to his wife complaining about the project. And from what I could gather from the story, it seemed like his wife gave it some thought and she made a suggestion on a way he can improve the project. He felt himself getting annoyed with her and agitated, and he snapped at her. He told me, "Why don't you stick to things that you actually understand? This is my project, not yours." And he told her, in a very devaluing way, "Your suggestions are not helpful." Clearly, he was dismissing and devaluing her input. That's example one. Here's example two. As John engages in therapy and works with his therapist, he gradually starts to recognize that he relies on him for support, guidance, and understanding. This realization only becomes conscious when his analyst is not available. Let's say the analyst is on vacation, there's some kind of separation, maybe he arrives to the appointment late, or in John's mind, he believes that his analyst is preoccupied. Okay, that's example two. And as you're listening, just one more example, and as you're listening to all three, see if you could figure out what the thread is that runs through all three of these examples. Example three. She comes in and she talks about a long weekend trip that she took with her husband that she barely survived. In other words, it was a horrible experience. As I look closely at the details, what I began to hear is she actually had a nice time. And it was even a moment where she suggested that she had the wish to stay longer, that she wished the trip was a little bit longer. On the car ride home, she felt he was short with her and being provocative. And this quickly escalated into a pretty intense fight between them. And she was angry and she threatened again to divorce him. As I listened more, as I explored this and I listened closely to her associations around this story in detail, what I began to realize is she brought up what's considered a very sensitive topic in their relationship, and he got annoyed with her. So the pleasant trip turned into, I barely survived. In all three examples, here are the main points that capture the nature of the relationship that these individuals form. Avoidance of any close contact with others, and more importantly, avoidance of any close contact with their own inner feelings. Making any genuine contact arouses dangerous, envious, or paranoid thoughts and feelings. Each of these individuals deal with these feelings, these fears, by approaching the other in a superior way. This is the omnipotence. They devalue the other. In their superior, omnipotent attitude, they deny any need for dependency. Accepting something of value, for instance, they can't accept something of value from his wife. That was the suggestion on the project. From her husband, which was the pleasant trip, and from his therapist. They can't accept something of value because they feel so threatened. And anxieties, as I mentioned before, dangerous, envious anxieties begin to get aroused in them, which then they need to get rid of quickly. Okay, so let's understand this now a little bit more deeply. In order to do this, we need to turn to the literature. In the literature, so this is the psychoanalytic literature, but this is also the social media content literature, if I can call it that. So in other words, I just listen to the podcast. I turn to YouTube because it's always fun to see how these things are being discussed in this day and age. So when I turn to the literature, what I'm looking for is, what's the understanding of the omnipotence and how it plays a role in relationships? One thing that came out, and you may have heard this already, this is very popular in the literature. It's love bombing. What is love bombing? This is the image, if we think about it from a psychoanalytic perspective, right? The love bombing is the image of the idealized self and the idealized other in this perfect, harmonious, magical, blissful union. All right. If you have listened to any of my earlier podcasts, you might remember I discussed this in The Craving and in The Paranoid Narcissist. I spoke about with every narcissist has a mode of repair. And the mode of repair is different depending on the type or cluster of narcissism. But the ultimate goal is what? To recapture the early blissful narcissistic stage that was, in theory, interrupted prematurely and abruptly. Okay? So this is very similar to the love bombing, right? Is that with the love bombing, they're trying to create this atmosphere. And once, again, according to the literature, social media content, once they suck you in, right? Once they have you, then the devaluing begins. They minimize you. They discard you. And then the other person gets fed up with this eventually, and they leave the narcissist. And then the narcissist can feel victimized, right? That nothing ever works out for him or her, or look what these people do to me. The person leaves the relationship. Then, again, according to what I discovered, this is very common, what this is known as hoovering. Now, you may be familiar with these terms. So we have the love bombing, then we have devaluing, and now we have hoovering, which is the next stage where they try to draw you back in, right? They start texting. They start, I guess, again, the love bombing phase, right? And they're trying to win you back. In this process, why does the narcissist move from love bombing to devaluing? In other words, why do they devalue you once they have you? Now, the reason for the shift, it's been explained, is, for instance, maybe they get bored, right? That the narcissistic supplies that the other is offering them become stale, and they get bored, and they then devalue the other person, and that starts, you know, that continues this whole process. Now, I think this is possibly one way to explain these stages of the relationship, the way it develops. But I don't think it fully explains it. And I want to go a little bit further. What doesn't it explain? In my mind, when I heard this, my first immediate question was, how does that happen? How does somebody just suddenly get bored? Why do they get bored? Right? In other words, if they have the narcissistic supplies, what's the problem? And why do they get bored today and not yesterday? Like, why didn't they get bored yesterday? See, I think these are all legitimate questions. And I want to give the caveat that it is true that there is some level of boredom for those not for all, but for those particular narcissists who perhaps function in more of a borderline way, who are drawn to the drama of a relationship, right? That somehow the desire for the volatility is the thing that is most appealing to them, which is interesting because then it's not the supplies, which is then a whole nother theory, by the way, because this is, again, more characteristic, in my opinion, of somebody who's closer to functioning in a borderline way than a narcissistic way. But that's a discussion for another episode. If you're interested in hearing more about that, shoot me an email. Okay, so let's get back to business. We have the descriptive picture in mind. I gave these three examples, but to develop a deeper understanding of this picture, yes, now it's time. We need to pull from and borrow a little bit of psychoanalytic theory. There are many different theories out there, and no one theory explains any phenomena. So what I'm about to describe to all of you is not just one theory. I want to focus in on one theory that I have found really helpful. But as I'm doing that, I'll borrow from other theoretical perspectives. Herbert Rosenfeld is a renowned psychoanalyst who has made significant contributions to understanding what he has come to call narcissistic omnipotent object relations. And that's exactly what we want to understand, because if at the beginning of this episode, I mentioned the most important piece, the defining characteristic of the narcissist is the omnipotent grandiose self. Remember, that was the mission of the episode, is we want to understand how does this play out in intimate relationships. It was Rosenfeld who extensively explored this concept, and it is thought, but this is amongst many psychoanalysts, that omnipotent fantasies originate in infancy at a time when a developing child is made to feel helpless, small, weak, and later in development, worthless or incapable. So how does this happen? If early on there are abrupt or sudden separations, or excessive separations, excessive frustration, excessive overindulgence, like I've described in earlier episodes, or a lack of holding and containing that the developing child needs, all of these things can contribute to the development and persistence of narcissistic structures. I described this in earlier episodes, that I don't feel that it's almost like if the developing child feels that the caregiver doesn't care about them, what they put up is known as an affect block. So in other words, this is the beginning of the grandiose sense of self. It's like, you don't care about me? I don't care about you. In fact, I don't care about anyone, right? Because they don't ever want to feel vulnerable, weak, or hurt again. So it's much safer to say, I don't care. I don't need anybody, right? So if the childhood disappointments and absences, this is critical, these are the separations, if they are too long, The baby developing child begins to feel that the caregiver is depriving them and keeping all the comforting pleasures to themselves. If the baby sees the caregiver as being mean and withholding, then destructive fantasies and impulses ensue. Up until this point, again, if you've listened to any of the earlier episodes, up until this point, I said what happens typically if there's this type of caregiver, a deep sense of shame begins to develop within oneself, that the child may feel like a nothing. But I have not emphasized this destructive part. So this is something new that we're bringing in. And I just want to, again, emphasize, it's never one or the other. There's always a mixture of all of this stuff happening simultaneously. It's just which one predominates. Because the baby, developing child, is now angry, they turn away in an attempt to hurt the caregiver and spoil the loving efforts to repair any damage that may have been done. So you could picture this. This is the baby who's angry, who feels destructive, and may even refuse to eat, right? This is maybe gets played out later in life in anorexia, for instance, right? Or other symptoms that narcissists typically experience. They're not just usually narcissistic. They usually come along with another set of symptoms as well. Sometimes addictions, sometimes eating disorders. So let's go back to the simple examples that I gave and see, how does this theory make any sense? If the baby is angry, the adult feels destructive and is refusing to eat, what does that have anything to do with the examples I gave? This is a woman I mentioned a moment ago who travels with her husband. She can't or won't take in, she won't recognize, she won't internalize a nice experience. Remember what I said, as I listened to her story closely, I heard her allude to the fact that it was an enjoyable trip and she wanted more, but then it all got spoiled. She pushed away the feeding. She pushed away the good meal. This is a man who cannot accept a suggestion. This is example number one when he was doing basic repairs around the house. This is a man who cannot accept a suggestion. Again, a good feed, someone trying to help him from his wife, or the patient that I mentioned, where he feels things are moving along and he's beginning to rely on his analyst. Suddenly that gets disrupted. He can no longer accept that. By the way, this phenomena that I'm describing may also be considered the potential origins of envy. And envy is very prominent in the narcissistic structure. So individuals, in other words, who have these narcissistic characteristics also typically suffer with a great deal of envy. Envy of what? Let's go back to the origins. Envy of the caregiver's capacity to give. Remember, the developing baby cannot get their needs met. They depend on somebody else. And when those needs are frustrated, a fantasy, this is what we're describing. And yes, this is inferential. This is why it's theory. We can't say for sure, but we have behavioral responses that have been studied by the baby watchers that suggest that there's a lot of evidence for this, that yes, early in life, at this early age, babies begin to demonstrate anger and aggression, right? So envy of the caregiver's capacity to give, and in the adult, envy of the partner's ability to love, or in the therapy that I described, example number three, envy of the therapist's understanding of the patient and the capacity to invest in a relationship. And most importantly, this is a capacity that the narcissistic individual lacks. And if they just lacked it, and it was something they didn't have, there wouldn't be so much envy. And this goes, now we're talking about treatment again, or how to relate to these people, or another testament to how these people are treatable. Again, something you don't typically hear if you do a survey of the social media content. I'll get on to that a little bit later. But it's something that they lack and they want. You see, they want to have this capacity. and they know they don't have it, that it's something in them that is missing. So the infant developing child is overly frustrated, feels weak and helpless, and destructive. To cope with all these intense feelings, the developing child not only builds up the grandiose, omnipotent sense of self. Remember, I don't need you. I don't need anybody. I could do this all on my own, right? But they also build up the omnipotent other. Omnipotently created objects. These are part objects at first, developmentally, if things go well. These turn into whole, loving objects that have thoughts and feelings and a mind of their own, which is okay. But when development does not go accordingly, like in these examples that I'm giving you, or in the origins of having this overly frustrating caregiver, things do not go well and a shift does not occur because there's not the develop of object constancy, something, again, I discussed in a prior episode. Go back and check that out. So these people in their life, in their mind, remain as part objects. And I'm using the word objects again because they're not whole people. They're not loving relationships that they're developing. So there's the omnipotent self and the omnipotent other. What is the role? I spoke about the role of the omnipotent self to defend against these painful experiences when they're children. But what's the role of the omnipotent other? The omnipotent other is the one who's supposed to be there to do what? To provide, to take care of you, to mirror you, to value you, right? So now we're getting into the sort of the heart of the omnipotent narcissistic object relationship. We have an omnipotent self paired with an omnipotently created other who is there to meet your needs. So this is the structure that develops, and the fantasy. And yes, these individuals, you know this already, the narcissist lives in a fantasy world. This is the love bombing. The love bombing is to sort of foster this fantastical world of what? Connectedness, with no separation exists. That's why it's the love bombing, the texting, the calling, the visits, the flowers, etc. So let's go back, actually. I mentioned the love bombing. Let's go back to the content review. Why do they devalue you once they have you? Or, well, the one reason we have is the supply, they get bored, right, with all the supply. But now we have an alternative explanation, right? This is what I'm trying to get at, is they don't just get bored with the supply. That the most important ingredient to the relationship is the omnipotent self paired with the omnipotently created object. If these two ingredients are not there, you don't have the cake. The relationship doesn't exist, in other words. Okay, so now you may be asking, can I be a little more specific? Because if an omnipotent self, an other, right, if we have that, how does that lead to them devaluing the other? Right. So what's the link? So we have to just go one step further. This piece is critical. Having this pair of the omnipotent self and other is critical to developing our understanding of the three examples that I gave earlier. So let me say it from a slightly different perspective. If an omnipotent self develops, also known as narcissistic self-idealization, you would see the following traits, right? An inflated sense of superiority, an exaggerated belief in their own abilities, and a disregard for the needs or perspectives of others. So here is the most important point. When the narcissistic omnipotent self, that's the self-idealization, diminishes, when it diminishes, or when the omnipotent self is challenged, the individual becomes aware of his need and dependency on the other. Remember, this whole structure is designed to create this illusion that they don't need anybody else. But when this is challenged, they begin to become more aware of their dependency on the other, on her husband, right? On that trip, right? With that woman. And all the examples that I mentioned earlier, why do they devalue you, though, once they realize this dependency? Now, the explanation we have is they become bored. But in my experience, the supply does not just suddenly become stale or they get bored. Remember earlier I said, why did it happen today? Why didn't it happen yesterday? How did it just suddenly happen? More importantly, something triggers the shift. And I'm not saying that this is always the case. Maybe they do get bored. Remember, I mentioned that earlier. But again, I typically see that more with borderline patients that I treat. And of course, there's significant overlap. You know, sort of behind every narcissistic structure is a borderline structure. It's the grandiose sense that separates them. Anyway, I digressed again. But something triggers the shift from love bombing to devaluing. But oftentimes, that which triggers the shift is so subtle, it goes unnoticed. And there's so much anger and so much fighting. It's like a big smoke screen. The subtle thing that triggers the shift goes unnoticed until you can slow them down and somebody, maybe not you, maybe me, right? Slow them down and explore very carefully what happened. And this is where it's so important to get into the details of these fights. Okay, with this in mind, let's return to example one to see if we can figure out what this something was that triggers the shift. And example number one, this is the simple renovation in the house, and this fellow gets stuck, right? First, when someone comes in and is raging at their wife, or if you're in this situation, or you know somebody who's in this situation, the first order of business is what? To always help them become more regulated. Anytime I hear somebody yelling or cursing, I know already that, in my mind at least, this is just the way that I conceptualize it. And by the way, this is what I find helpful. I'm not suggesting that this applies to every case and will apply to every situation. But what I find helpful is when someone is dysregulated, the first goal is to get them regulated, to help them regulate their emotions. Why is this so important? Because you can't talk to somebody who's dysregulated. It's impossible. So the first order of business is what? Slow them down, containment, listening, helping them get into a more regulated state of mind. One way to do this, which I often again find to be very successful, is to be curious and listen and encourage them to tell you about what happened. And then eventually, you could go beyond the descriptive, when they start to calm down, you could go beyond the descriptive material and try to tap into what was going on inside of you. What were you thinking when your wife made that suggestion? What were all the thoughts and feelings? And this is a little bit of review, but it's once when you're dealing with somebody like this who cannot hear you, it's always best to take up a position from their perspective. And this is what I've called appreciating the subjectively useful component of a maladaptive symptom. It's not condoning their behavior. It's not agreeing with their behavior. It's just demonstrating to them that you can hear it from their perspective. And already, this is most likely different than what anybody has ever done with them in their life. Sometimes I get the question, this is going to take a long time. And I say, you are absolutely right. Working with somebody with narcissistic personality disorder takes time. And it's not an easy job. But if things go accordingly, there should be incremental shifts along the way. Because as I was just saying, if you can listen to them in a way that's different than anybody has ever listened to them, that already will leave them with a different feeling. And this is a trajectory sometimes of what happens when you do that. So I review with this fellow what happened. And in the back of my mind, What I'm saying is the primary goal is in the narcissistic omnipotent object relationship is what? What is the primary goal of the narcissist? The omnipotent relating. This relationship is only attainable when he's receiving constant attention, admiration, acknowledgement from his wife. We can see in this example, the moment these supplies are unavailable, she makes a suggestion. She has a different opinion on the way he can improve the home renovation project. This, which by the way, this forces a separation. And you might remember earlier when I was talking about the origins of this type of relationship that I said absences and separations are prolonged and the baby feels that the caregiver is depriving them. They feel inadequate. They get angry. Remember that? So in this situation, as we begin to slow this fellow down and I'm talking to him, what I begin to understand with this in the back of my mind is at these moments, he feels frustrated because this is not just a different opinion. He's under attack. Remember, there's no such thing as an absent caregiver. There's only a hostile caregiver. These are people who grew up with too much frustration. So they're under attack. This is appreciating the subjectively useful component. I'm trying to appreciate it from his perspective. I'm not offering advice. I'm not telling him to create boundaries. I'm not telling him how to live his life. He's an adult. And those things typically don't work in my experience. So at these moments, what I find is when you could slow them down and get a little closer to their inner feelings, oftentimes you quickly hear how powerless, inadequate, helpless, or humiliated they feel, that they feel more accurately that they're being made to feel this way. That's the way I should say it. In other words, that it's not just that they feel this way, but they're being made to feel this way. In other words, somebody's doing something to them. And that's the piece that I just mentioned, that they're under attack. But we understand where that comes from. And since we understand it, we can be a little bit more patient or empathic with them. And this, by the way, goes to how do I relate to people like this in my life? The first thing is we need to understand what's going on. And that makes it a little less personal. Again, I'm not condoning the behavior, right? But if you can begin to understand where it's coming from, it puts you in a position to be able to talk to them in a different way. And when you talk to them in a different way, and you're not just fighting, and you're trying to understand them, almost always, I find this with my couple, the couples that I work with as well, it begins to diffuse the anger. The anger goes down. And as you begin to help these people, these individuals, learn how to use language in a way to communicate something, now there's this possibility for it because the dysregulation is down, they're more regulated. And when you're more regulated, you have a better capacity for symbolic functioning, which is the use of language. So one of the main ways they make themselves feel better before, you know, if we don't get them to this point that I was just describing, where we help them become more regulated, is what makes them feel better is mobilizing the omnipotent self, right? That's the self-idealization. But that's part of the whole part of the problem in terms of narcissistic object relations. That's what just sort of perpetuates the cycle of what I said before, the love bombing, devaluing, and then the hoovering. The hoovering is trying to get them back and recreate the blissful experience of the love bombing. We need to interrupt that cycle. That's our goal. So this fellow, he's under attack, and therefore he has to destroy her and devalue her. In essence, he's saying to her, you're little, not me. I don't need anything from you. He minimizes and destroys what she has to offer him. So the tools, the techniques, again, I could talk to him about his behavior now. If I'm coming from the inside, from his own subjective experience, it's not a judgment because he's now more regulated. He's calm. He's in a more receptive mode. And when I talk to him now, I can demonstrate that given how he's feeling and this is the part about appreciating it from his perspective, I'm not agreeing with it, but I can begin to talk to him about how I can understand why he would behave in this way. In other words, I can actually begin to say to him, she's trying to be helpful, but for him, that's not your subjective experience. What we come to see as he talks about this more is there are many different levels of this. And of course, these things take time, as I mentioned earlier. So this unfolds gradually with many different examples. So this part right here, I'm summarizing now, but I just want to give you some sense of what begins to emerge over time when you use these strategies. She's trying to be helpful. And for him, we come to discover the subjective experience is, one, it arouses regressive wishes that he finds intolerable. In other words, the baby who wants to be taken care of. You might remember I discussed this in another episode on the craving narcissist. That's the baby who always wants to be taken care of. But for the grandiose, right? The grandiose narcissist finds this too humiliating because it's not their mode of repair. Two, he doesn't really feel competent to handle this on his own or to figure out how to handle the project, to do some research or really think through the project instead of just getting frustrated. In other words, he begins to realize he can't handle this project like an adult, a fully functioning adult. And that too is humiliating. But instead of dealing with the humiliation, which is what we're doing now, because we're talking about it, he becomes enraged and takes the omnipotent position and reestablishes the omnipotent object relationship. Three, because she is an adult and she can handle this and think about it and give him advice, she's grown up and she has the answers. And she could give them to him. And she can do this so freely. And she has an abundance of care to give. This is the envy that I was talking about earlier. So if I state that slightly differently, he has so much envy and rage that she has what he wants, but he can't manufacture on his own. In other words, he doesn't have so much to give in abundance. But she does, and that enrages him. And it enrages him. I know I mentioned this earlier. It's important that I keep going over this because it really speaks to how these individuals, you can help them. We can relate to them. They are treatable. Not all of them, but this is suggesting that she has something that he wants, but that he does want to be able to relate like this. Example number two. As John engages in therapy and works with his analyst, he gradually starts to recognize that he relies on the analyst for support and comforting, and he begins to feel good. Remember that example. This creates pain and anxiety. And then he comes into the session and he begins to rely on me. Oh, by the way, I was the analyst in this example. So as he begins to rely on me, and what happens? He reestablishes a narcissistic, omnipotent object relationship with me. How does he do that? He comes in and instead of recognizing his increasing feelings of dependency and vulnerability, his pain and the pain that goes along with that, he comes to session and he demands to be given the answers to his problems. And he devalues me for not giving him the answers. Everything that he was just beginning to value in me completely disappears. That's the splitting, by the way. And by the way, this is also what happens in example number three with the woman. She begins to value something in her husband on that trip and has a longing to stay, to extend the trip, but that becomes too painful. And for her, it gets triggered on the way home. Because what's happening on the way home, the trip is coming to an end. I'll say more about that in a moment. I'm digressing again. Let me stay with this example. So he begins to recognize that he values something. There's an increase in dependency. He comes in and he devalues me. And it's the same approach that I mentioned in the first example. I begin to talk to him about his experience of being with what I call an incompetent analyst that does not answer his questions. You see, I play the role. Like, I hold the projection initially. I even say an incompetent analyst who doesn't have the answers, because I want to get close to his experience of what it's like to be with somebody who doesn't have the answers and who, in his mind, is preoccupied. Like, he felt one day, and this is what triggered it, by the way. He came in one day and felt that I was preoccupied with my own business and I wasn't paying close attention to him. Now, of course, I was not preoccupied, but he needed to see me this way. And we'll get into that a little bit later. But for now, I would say, and this is, again, about how you relate to people like this. If he sees me as preoccupied, what am I supposed to do now? Get into an argument or try to convince him that I'm not preoccupied? See, this is how these things escalate very quickly in everyday life, right? And this, again, is this is the work that I do with couples, is I could show them how quickly this escalates, because somebody will say something that seems so silly, but it seems silly, but it's not silly to them. It's very serious. And it happens at a particular moment for a particular reason. And if you could hold it just for a moment and remain curious, engage your curiosity, then you could begin to understand why at this particular moment am I being accused of being an incompetent analyst who is preoccupied. So first, we need to hear it from his perspective. And that's the most important thing that I could say at this moment, because we have to begin to wrap things up. But I just want to leave you with this thought, is first, we appreciate it from his perspective, because in order for him to hear you, he first needs to be heard. In other words, if you feel like you have something to say to somebody like this in your life, before they can hear you, they need to have a feeling that you are capable and interested in hearing it from their perspective. And by the way, this is all about object constancy again. I really do encourage you to go back and listen to that episode. But part of object constancy is the capacity to feel close to somebody and remain and to be able to sustain that sort of close, loving relationship, despite the fact that they see things in a way that's very different than the way that you see it. In other words, two separate individuals can exist. And it doesn't mean there needs to be a fight or a disagreement. It's an appreciation that they have a different perspective, and it can be very different than yours. Think about politics. Think about some of your family members or good friends who have very different political views than you. You may say to yourself, this is crazy. This person sounds crazy that they would support such and such a person. But you have to keep in mind that at the same time, they think you're crazy because you don't support that person, or you support somebody from the opposing party, right? Anyway, there's so much more to say, but we have to hold off. The intricacies of the love bombing stage and the subsequent omnipotent incorporation of the object raise important questions that deserve much more exploration and definition. I just mentioned omnipotent incorporation. We didn't even get to that today. And maybe this will be a good place for us to pick up when we go into episode 2 of what may turn out to be a series, and rightly so, because the way these individuals relate to other people in their life is so complicated. It deserves quite a bit of space. To truly understand and facilitate improvement in these relationship dynamics, a more comprehensive analysis is necessary. For instance, what would have to happen for improvement to occur? Now, you may have realized I'm already touching on this, but there's so much more to say about, and it's a good thing that there is much more to say in terms of how we can improve these relationships and break that cycle of the love bombing, devaluing, and then the hoovering. But regrettably, we must conclude our discussion here for now. However, I encourage you to reach out with any questions or comments regarding narcissistic object relations. This topic is undeniably complex. What we went over today is very complicated. And if there's anything that I said that may have confused you, please feel free to send me an email. Stay tuned for part two. But in the meantime, as always, engage your mind. Disclaimer alert. The Narcissism Dakota podcast is provided for general information purposes only. The content presented in this podcast is not intended to diagnose, treat, or cure any psychological condition related to narcissism. The content on this podcast should not be considered a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. For specific advice pertaining to narcissism or any other psychological condition, you could reach me directly. I am an experienced mental health practitioner who is always taking on new patients. If you would just like a consultation, I can do that too.